When I set up, I have the knowledge of time and space on a stand, so I have it open so that there's just a couple of pages open at a time. And when I set it up, I opened it to the wrong chapter. I opened it to the previous chapter, and that made me read the first sentence of the previous chapter, and that's actually an interesting place to start, even though it was a mistake. The first sentence says, "Just as the senses predispose us to determine experience in certain ways, so we measure experience out in accord with other faculties and predispositions." The reason that struck me just now was that we are interested in the feel of the senses, right? We're looking at how we can really, you might say, open or deepen or expand or make more rich or meaningful our sense experience. And the point that that sentence makes is that the senses, the way they usually operate, and of course that's exactly what we're wanting to call into question, but the way that they usually operate, they predispose us, as it says here, to determine experience in certain ways. And I think that that's really, in a sense, you could say that's at the heart of what we're doing here. We are looking for ways to depredispose. That's not quite the right way to say it, but that's kind of the idea. We would like to be able to understand something about how sense experience gets set up so that we can change it. You might think of it as you have an auditorium and you set it up for one kind of an event, and we have set up our lives for one kind of an event, which I suppose is the I event, right? That's what's now playing, and that's what's always playing, starring the eye. Now we want to set up the auditorium for a different kind of event, or at least that would be a useful next step. If you set up the auditorium for a different event, then, and you've never done that before, then you might realize, first of all, you can set it up lots of different ways, and then you might find yourself asking, well, who is it who owns this auditorium anyway, and who books the acts, and those kinds of questions are the kinds of questions that we want to be asking in TSK, and particularly in this case, in terms of our program, those are the questions that we want to be asking with regard to the senses. Okay, so all that comes from having opened to the wrong page. Now let me go to the right page because I actually wanted to look at the first line of the first paragraph of this page. So this sentence on page 384 starts out, "From the empty mind of awareness, how does the quality of the knowable take form?" That's the question. How does the quality of the knowable take form from the empty mind of awareness? So we've got these two different terms, I guess, awareness and the knowable. And that leads to the question, it seems to me, of the relationship between awareness and knowledge. And again, we're working towards sense knowledge. In other words, most of our knowledge comes from the senses, comes from perception, or at least that's a very important contributing factor. I don't want to get into, how much of it or anything like that. But we rely very heavily on our senses for our knowledge. So that knowledge has been determined. We're predisposed. That's what the previous chapter told us. And it arises out of, it takes form from the empty mind of awareness. So that's what I want to focus on for the first few minutes here, and it'll be a little theoretical, and then we'll try to make it more practical. We'll do an exercise, and see where that leads us. So the empty mind of awareness. So we have this word empty, and those of you who are familiar with Buddhist thought know that emptiness plays a very important role in Buddhist thought, especially in the Mahayana. And I suppose my own thinking is colored by that. I have to imagine that Rinpoche's thinking is colored by that too, since since that's his tradition. Our way of thinking about the word empty, that is in our culture, is that whatever is empty is kind of worthless. It's been used up, or it just is. There's a possibility there maybe to fill it with something, but what counts is what you fill it with. But more typically, empty is what's left when there's nothing more valuable to talk about. The box of cereal is empty, and so you throw it away. But of course, that's not what Rinpoche is saying here. What he's saying here is empty means something like open for all possibilities. So if you go back to that auditorium, you could say, on the stage of the auditorium, anything can happen. You can book any act. Or a little closer to the image I was using, the auditorium is like it's just a box, right? And you can set up chairs in it in any configuration you want, or you can set up cushions, or you can make it a dance space, or you can play basketball or whatever. Empty means open. It's kind of infinite possibilities. And I think that that's really what's being said here in terms of awareness. The awareness allows for experience to emerge. And the specific form that that experience takes is determined, and we'll look at that in a moment. But first, I just wanted to get clear on this notion of empty. Now, sometimes people in the Buddhist tradition, when Westerners are trying to translate the term that usually gets translated as emptiness, sometimes they say openness. And you could say the open mind of awareness. And that's actually nice. I like that. But it is a little bit, the term has already been taken over. It's been used up. And that makes it maybe not quite the right term, because we say, I have an open mind. Right? And at least when I hear that phrase, it suggests to me that there are different possibilities. There are two alternatives, and I'm willing to listen to both of them. I have an open mind. I haven't made my mind up. And that's way too limited, because it's saying, the world has already been narrowed down into these two alternatives, or three or four or whatever, and I'm going to choose among them, and I haven't made the choice yet. But of course, I have made the choice that these are the alternatives that are open to me. So open mind, although it's got kind of the right flavor, that openness, it's like you've been in a dark, closed space, and then you emerge into the open, and it feels very liberating. That sense of open is just right. So if you want to think about it that way, you can. But the basic point here is that awareness is absolutely undetermined. It's got all potential within it. I'll give you another analogy. As many of you know, in the Nyingma community, one of the things we kind of specialize in is electric prayer wheels. Nobody ever made electric prayer wheels before Rinpoche started making electric prayer wheels, as far as I know. And we've made many, many, many. There's way over 1,000 electric prayer wheels in our communities, big, big guys. And sometimes people say, well, that doesn't make any sense, because I can understand kind of the idea of a prayer wheel. You turn the wheel, and the prayers are sent out through the act of turning the wheel. But if you just do it electrically with no human turning the wheel, there's no intention. You know, how can that possibly allow for anything? And one of the first times I raised that question a long time ago, I don't remember who I was talking with, but the idea that I came away with was there is something very wonderful about building a prayer wheel, let's say, and it's got a cord and it's got a plug, and you plug that wall, that plug into the wall, into the electrical system, and now this very fundamental energy of the universe, electricity, which could power anything at all, is being harnessed for generating prayers. And there's something very beautiful and wonderful in that, and you know, it's taking, it's sort of shifting and shaping the energies of the universe. You could think about it that way. Well, you don't need to worry about, you know, whether that's a valid interpretation of how prayer wheels work or electricity works, but I think it's a good image because the point is that awareness can go anywhere. And the difference, you know, what's important for us is that's a little different from the prayer wheel, say, is that for us it's important to be able to bring alive again the connection, which is like the flow of electricity. You know, here we are, we determine a world, we inhabit a field, and that's what we've been talking about, but all of that is an expression, all of that is a manifestation of the underlying awareness. And we'd like to be able to open that connection. So awareness here is a really positive word. It's not one that's used so often in TSK, I don't think, but you know, the idea here is very much related, I think, to what in other places Rinpoche refers to as great knowledge. It's the infinite potential, no matter how it expresses itself, it's already there. So that original awareness, we're still on the first sentence here, that original awareness gives rise to the quality of the knowable. Something takes form. And in a sense, that's a dimming down. You know, the awareness is rich in possibilities and potential. Something is limited. Something takes form. But what takes form is you know, if we just look at the words of the sentence, you could say, well, it's the knowable, but he doesn't exactly say that, right? He says it's the quality of the knowable. So it's not just this and that, or even the whole range of this, thises and thats. It's the quality of the knowable, and to me, that really points back toward what we've been looking at, which is the field and field determinations, right? The quality of the knowable is what the field allows for, right? The field determines the range of possibilities. It's the, you know, the field gets determined, but it also allows for certain kinds of determinations, and I think that that's the quality of the knowable. So that's what I wanted to say about that first sentence, which I think is very rich. Now, in the rest of that paragraph, Rinpoche gives an answer to the question that he's asked in the first sentence. How does the quality of the knowable take form based on the empty mind of awareness? And the answer is, and he says, you know, we don't want to give any usual answers. We've enough already with the usual answers. And he says something that, you know, is fairly abstract. He says, there's a process of feedback. And based on the feedback, there's recognition. Based on the recognition, there's perception. Based on the perception, and notice we're in the realm of the senses now, based on the perception, we can pronounce mind and matter. And Rinpoche uses this word pronounce in a very a kind of an unusual way, and this shows up a lot in the TSK books. The idea is, pronounce means to speak out, right? Like announce. The very power of speaking something out, of labeling, creates what's there. So probably the right image is in Western, or I should say American English, wedding ceremonies. The person who has the authority of the state says, "I now pronounce you man and wife." And that's the kind of pronunciation we're talking about. By saying it, it becomes so. Until then, it wasn't, but it's been pronounced, and that's how it is. So mind and matter get pronounced. Subject and object get pronounced. Self and existence get pronounced. Self and others, here and there. The whole range gets pronounced. And it's because of the field, which has been established through feedback, right? And there's this really interesting connection between those two things. Okay, we'll let Karen finish her phone call. Okay. So there's a process by which this happens, and I'm not going to try to spell out or go into that process too much. It's just a whole thing in itself. But it starts with feedback. He says there's a process of feedback, and then that has certain results. But that's interesting because in order for there to be feedback, something has to be generating the feedback. And that something, I think, again, points us toward the field. Sometimes we've talked about the feel of the field, and I will do that again in a moment, but this is kind of like the feed of the field. Not that that's a term in TSK, it's just a term that I made up for purposes of this class. But the field is determined in such a way that it feeds back certain possibilities. It's the quality, again, the quality of the field feeds back these possibilities, and then on the basis of all that, the usual structures get set up. So the opposite of that, or let's say if we want to do something about that, it's the feel of the field, and that's what we've been exploring. There's something very open in the field, but when we've labeled things and pronounced things, and that openness has been turned into the knowable. That's already, I mean, that's still fairly open, but it's definitely, it's too late. Something has already happened, and we are kind of determined now to go in certain directions in both senses of the word determined, which we've talked about before. So the way out of that that we've been exploring over the last few weeks is to, instead of going to what the field determines, to go to the feel of the field. You could say the qualities of the field, maybe, but I think feel is a little better. It's more experiential, you might say. So the feel of the field, that's been our kind of gateway out of the determined, the known and knowable range of our experience. So that's where I'm heading right now. In a few minutes we'll do an exercise, but I want to say just a couple of more things about that. Before we do that. So in the field, so far we've basically dealt with the first paragraph on page 384, or dealt with isn't such a good term, but we've been working with with that paragraph. So in the second paragraph, Something new comes up. He says, distinctions arise through symbols of communication that are not positioned. So, this is another one of these phrases where you read it and either you kind of skip over it and don't really think about it too hard, or you do think about it, but you don't know what to think. You don't, at least that's my experience. You ask yourself, well, what is a symbol of communication? It seems so removed. I mean, communication is already pretty abstract, and then you've got a symbol of communication. What can he be talking about here? And that's a big topic. I would suggest that if you want to explore the notion of symbols in TSK, there's a fairly short but very interesting discussion of that in Love of Knowledge. You can just look up symbol in the index to Love of Knowledge and you'll find it. But what I want to say about it here is just very general, you could say. And that is that at least in our ordinary understanding, we have to start with that, I think, a symbol symbolizes something, right? It has a symbolic meaning. And the question is, where does it get that meaning from? If I say, oh, I don't know, if I say an eagle symbolizes the United States, that's not built into the eagle. Or even you could say the American flag, that's a man-made symbol, whereas an eagle is kind of, it's also a man-made symbol, but the bird was there. But in both cases, the symbol gets its symbolic significance through our assigning meaning to it. And so the question is, how do you decide, how do you assign that meaning? Well, again, it seems to point toward the field, right? And Rinpoche says in this same paragraph, he talks about zero gravity. Again, that's the notion of gravity and the way that works in TSK is something we could spend a lot of time on. But the idea, in a sense, is that zero gravity is the notion of complete freedom. The power of the symbol represents that freedom. But what it symbolizes, that's where the zero gravity becomes heavy, where it takes on some specific meaning or content. And he talks about that. He says, so in the beginning you have zero gravity, but in fact positions and polarity arise, and then you get the whole world, viewpoints and ways of cognizing and all of that. So, symbols are you might say that the symbols are the symbol of, are themselves the symbol of this transition from awareness to the knowable, because the power of the symbol could be used in any way, but it's turned into something specific. So when we're talking about symbols, and when Rinpoche says that distinctions depend on symbols, I think he's trying to hold open a little while longer this possibility or this emphasis on the allowing of awareness, right? So the emptiness of awareness is always available, and that's true when you look at a symbol. The symbolic meaning of a symbol is empty. It's not there in the thing. It's been assigned through communication. So something gets communicated, something gets named, something gets pronounced, but the very activity of naming or pronouncing is a way of pointing back toward the power, the open, allowing emptiness of awareness. So it's kind of like, there's a theory in cosmology these days, and these theories come and go. It's progress is made in cosmology, but people keep finding that we know less and less than we thought we did. But there's a notion sometimes in cosmology that the universe was created out of nothing. So I'm thinking, of course, here of the allowing emptiness of awareness. The universe was created out of nothing through a kind of random fluctuation. And that has to do with the way that quantum physics works. We don't have to go into that, and I couldn't really go into that. But, you know, this idea that you could create something out of nothing is very interesting. But allowing awareness is not something that where it makes sense to talk about a random fluctuation. What happens is that something gets created through a kind of backward projecting based on feedback. That's what Rinpoche has been talking about here. And one way to think about that is that our sense of linear time, you know, where we say, well, something, there's an initial state of affairs and then things get created on the basis of that. There's a source for the way things are. But in terms of allowing awareness and the kind of open freedom of the symbol, that way of understanding time may be too limited. And you know, there's already been over 100 pages in this book, which we haven't touched at all, about, you know, discussing the nature of time. But so I'm just briefly kind of waving at that, just referring to that possibility. But that would be kind of the sense, I think, that the allowing awareness remains available within our immediate experience. Okay, so now I want to do a practice, and because, you know, I mean, this is a concern that I often have when we're working with the TSK books, and especially when I'm just sort of rambling on and there's not much, and I'm not getting any feedback, that maybe this all seems very abstract. I would like to try to make it a little more concrete, and I want to do that in a very simple way, and it's based on a statement that Rinpoche makes. Let's see if I can. At the bottom of page 385, in the last full paragraph, he's talking about how these patterns, you know, these pages, these two pages here, are very much concerned with how something is created out of nothing. You know, how the field and its qualities, which give rise to the knowable, are take form out of the allowing awareness, allowing emptiness of awareness. And he spends some time working this out. And then at the bottom of page 385, of that last full paragraph, he says, this basic pattern, what he's been describing, continues to expand outward in a movement that seems as natural as breathing. So the word breathing is something more concrete than this abstraction. And so I thought that's where we could take our stand. And this is actually something I've been experimenting with a little myself for a while, different ways of working with the breath. So here's the practice. There is this patterning, there is this expanding outward that creates a world, and it's a kind of a creative, you know, it is a creative act. Usually we think of creativity as being something positive, you know, and it is. You know, the creative forces allow for something new, they create the possibility of freedom, they allow for freedom, and so on, and that's all great. But in this particular connection, we're saying the creativity narrows down. You know, it's a little bit like if you have a block of clay and you make some shape out of it, And perhaps you're a great artist, you make something very wonderful out of it, but that's that. The possibility that was represented by the block of clay has been narrowed down into this one possible, into this one shape and form. It's the kind of creativity we're talking about. So it's positive. It's very exciting to be able to tune into that creativity, but it also has this kind of narrowing down effect, and we can explore both of those things. And the way I want to do that is very simple. When you breathe in, just let yourself imagine that in that breathing in, you are creating the field that you inhabit. Or perhaps it's better not to say that you are creating it, just say that that act of breathing in creates the field that you inhabit, the world that you inhabit, and that it's a kind of a projecting and a pronouncing and a presenting, all these things that Rinpoche talks about in these pages. But I don't want you to try to, single out the projecting, say this part's the projecting, this part's the feedback, this part's the naming, the pronouncing. No, that's all an attempt to try to clarify what's going on. But we just want to be tuned in to the sense of creating. So when, with the in-breath, think of that as a creating the field that you inhabit. And then the out-breath is just inhabiting that field. And then in the next in-breath, it's a creating again, and it may be a field that looks a lot like the one that you just inhabited, or it may be something completely different, because in fact, in our experience, one moment we're looking at the table, and the next moment we're thinking about breakfast. So the field may be completely different, or different in very fundamental ways. But in each case, let the in-breath be your kind of axis, for creation. So the in-breath is the creating of the field that you inhabit. Okay, let's try that for a few minutes here, and then we will discuss it. And that's going to be all we have time for today. So let's go ahead and give it a try. Okay, so I will give people a chance to reflect on that for a moment and then see what kind of comments we get. If you'd like to write something in the chat window there, or we're open for live comments as well. I'm going to start off by saying something, and that is that it seems to me, I'm just looking at my experience in doing the exercise just now, it seems to me that there are two stages, or I found two stages in doing it. And in the first stage, that focus on the in-breath is a way of entering into the experience more fully. And then in the second stage, the focus on the in-breath makes you start to look more at the process of creativity, how something is set up or takes form out of the allowing emptiness of awareness. That's the phrasing that Rinpoche has used. So those two stages seem to me to be interesting and important. So I'm looking at David's comment now, and he says, okay, several people are coming in now, but let's start off with David. So David says, breathing in anchors me in the present moment. Breathing out allows for exploring it. And I think that's very similar to what I just said, that kind of anchor. I used the term before that the breath can be an access for experience, but anchor is a very good term. And then David describes something about the, I guess it's your front porch, David. I always imagine you sitting on this on this front porch. The full foliage of the maple branches and leaves, breathing out, you explore them, and there's a sense of freedom and openness, a newness to the view, a brightness to the colors, a happiness. Well, that's very nice. And I think it does go in the direction of, when everything is a kind of creative thrust of awareness, let's call it that, then it's got this tremendous aliveness. It's just filled with potential. And that really is where we want to be going. Robert says, too, a stronger connection to what was presented, and it felt more alive and organic. And Sudaba says, so resting at ease, that is the field that I am part of, it's creation. Okay, I'm not quite sure I said that right. But anyway, the idea is that it's very true. It's always true here, and it's very difficult to kind of stay with that. It's always true that the self is a part of what's being created. Not the one who's in charge, the one who's been responsible, the one who's been hired. Nah, not like that. Sudhabha says, but I had a hand or a part in its creation, a sense of responsibility and more a feeling of being at ease that I have a hand in it. Well, it's a very interesting point. I just said, no, the self isn't, the self is not the creator. So let's stay with that image for a moment. In English, we say the self is a hired hand. The self has been given a job in this creation. The self, you could say, is the one that pronounces, for instance. And that's a nice way of thinking about it. And I do think, it's very interesting to bring in the idea of responsibility, because we're not just the enjoyer. We're not just the one who's standing back and looking. It's like, for those of you who are on the who are joining in by computer, we have this really very beautiful photograph that I've been admiring. That's part of the email announcement of the TSK retreat. I think I actually took that photo, but I've been admiring it. I didn't realize it was quite as lovely as it is. It's this bridge, right? So we can admire it and say, "Oh, look at how the light plays on it. What a beautiful photo." But we can also, we can be the ones who are walking on the bridge, and that's taking responsibility. So Bruce comments, and this is the last comment, and I'll take a look at it and and then we'll stop for today. So Bruce says that it wasn't easy to begin with. There was a sense that there was no center or single origin to the whole of the field of experience. And he talks about the relationship to an exercise from the TSK book called Transcendence of Pointings. So it's a mutual pointing, or he says a kind of global kaleidoscopic unfolding along the breath. Well, it's very nice. I like the word along there quite a bit. A global kaleidoscopic unfolding. And that's right. You know, we've said, I used the term anchor, David used the term, and I used the term axis. David used the term anchor, and Bruce is saying, well, right, but there's not one center or a single origin. Or maybe he doesn't say right, maybe he says wrong. He says there's not one center. I think there's plenty of room for both of those things to be true. So you might want to explore, you might want to do this exercise again during the week. It's an easy exercise. One of the things, you know, I love to work with the breath because it's always there, it's always available, and we don't have to manufacture it or direct it or control it. And not only is it always there, but it's there, you know, I don't know, 5 or 10 or 15 times in a minute. You know, you get to do the exercise over and over and over again. So maybe you'd like to work with that during the course of the week, and report, have some discussion about it online, of course. So good. For next week, we'll go on and read the next chapter, which is about twice as long as this one. And in the next chapter, Rinpoche finally, from our point of view, finally, starts talking more about the senses. They've come up occasionally, but we will be focusing in these last three sessions now more really on the feel of the senses in light of everything that we've been exploring. So thank you very much, everybody.